This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on Masters in Business, I am thrilled, and I really mean that, thrilled to be able to sit down with Byron Wien. You know, every now and then I wake up and just pinch myself that I get to sit down with some of the most fascinating people in finance and ask them questions. I don't know Byron Wien. I've never met Byron Wien before. They don't even let me near the Blackstone or Morgan Stanley buildings, so I couldn't even stick my resume in his hand 20 years ago. But here's a guy that I've always wanted to meet. He's a legend on Wall Street, and as you will see, he is not only knowledgeable and insightful, but as charming as could possibly be. Really, just a delightful conversation. For those of you who may not know who Byron Wien is, he is currently the vice chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners. Blackstone manages, I don't know, $1 trillion or some insane number. Prior to that, he briefly worked as a strategist, helping to guide the decisions of Pequot Capital, which was a huge hedge fund. And for several decades before that, he was the chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley. So this is a guy who's had a long and storied career on Wall Street, who has pretty much seen everything that there is to see, and really is very much an out-of-the-box thinker. You know, Wall Street strategists have to make these predictions all the time, and they're invariably terrible. So Byron very cleverly, some 30 years ago, came up with the idea of, instead of trying to predict where will the Dow be, where will the S&P be, where will the 10-year be, instead he comes up with these predictions that he thinks are surprises. The average person thinks that this is not likely to happen, but he thinks that there's a better than even money chance that these surprises happen. It was a great device to avoid making the usual predictions and looking wrong, and also a very good thought-provoking exercise. The other thing I've been reading of his now for, I want to say, over a decade has been The Smartest Man in Europe, which allows him to give voice to a third party who describes the perspective from Europe, which is very, very different than what we see here in the United States. And it's been if you've read this, you know what I'm talking about. It's a fascinating, very different approach to making market commentary and observations about what's going on. It was just really intriguing. So unlike just about every other interview I've done, I've never met Byron before today. I managed to wrangle him into doing this on the strength of some of our prior guests, and I'm just thrilled he came and sat with us for an hour and change. He's just so knowledgeable and so informative. Let me take us to the interview with Byron Wien.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, I am thrilled and privileged to have with me truly a legend on Wall Street. His name is Byron Wien, and we're going to spend some time discussing his background, his history, and what he's seen pretty much 50 years on Wall Street. Is that a fair statement? So there are some people out there, and this is hard to imagine, there are some people out there who may not know who you are. So let me set you up as you were chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley for 21 years. After that, you became vice chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners. In 1998, you were named by First Call the most widely read analyst on Wall Street. In 2000, you were ranked as the number one strategist. In 2006, New York Magazine named you as one of the 16 most influential people on Wall Street. And in 2008, the New York Society of Security Analysts presented you with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Byron Wien, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Barry.
So let's start out a little bit with your background and your introduction to Wall Street. You have a really unusual background. You were working full-time at age 15. How do you go from there to Harvard? How does that happen?
Well, that was sort of a dark period in my life. I was born in Chicago to a middle-class family. My father was a doctor. We lived on the North Side. I went to public schools. My parents had sort of a feeling that you shouldn't go to private schools. You should go to school with everybody else. My father died, had a stroke and died when I was 9. He was 46.
Very young.
My mother lived 5 years after that. When I was 14, she died. So suddenly at 14, I was an orphan. And my father had left enough money for food and rent. My mother had a sister who came to live with us while in the final years of my mother's life, and she stayed on with me. We moved to a smaller apartment in Chicago so I could continue to go to the same high school. But I had to go to work after school if I was going to have any money to go to the movies on Saturday, buy any clothes, do anything else. And I went to work downtown as an office boy, and that was my first exposure to business. In the meantime, I was going to school, and I was getting all A's, so I was still excelling in school. And when I was a senior, I was called to the principal's office. This was an inner-city public high school, and getting called to the principal's office was never a good thing.
Bad news.
I walked in, and the principal wasn't there, but the guidance counselor was. And he said, "Ween," because nobody in the school had ever been addressed by his first name. "Ween, do you own a suit?" And I said, "I did." He said, "Do you own a shirt and tie?" I said, "I did." He said, "Have you ever heard of Harvard?" I said, "Yeah, I've heard of it." He said, "Well, Harvard is a very snooty place, you know, and they are looking for smart kids in public schools in the Midwest to diversify the student body." I think it's ironic to think that in 1949, their idea of diversity was a kid from a public school in the Midwest.
Right.
In
those liberal elite East Coast schools, of course,
right.
that is diversification.
And he said, "I'm gonna give you a sheet of paper. We want you to go downtown and talk to somebody. They're sending somebody from Cambridge to Chicago to interview people. They've told us we can send one kid down to talk to this guy, and you're our pick. And
wow.
Ween, I just want to say to you, when you go down there, don't make a fool of yourself." So I went down there, and presumably I didn't make a fool of myself. And this fellow, John U. Monroe, who was the assistant dean of admissions, he shepherded me through the process. And in the fall of 1950, I went to Harvard. And it literally changed my life.
Literally changed your life. In fact, you heard of the place as kind of a snooty upper crust place, but you liked it enough to go back there for Harvard Business School, didn't you?
Oh, I had a great experience there. I was on the Harvard Crimson. I learned how to write. I met all kinds of people that I wouldn't have been exposed to. I am forever grateful for having gone to Harvard.
That's fascinating.
The business school, yeah, Barry, it's a story you'll probably be amused at. So now I majored in chemistry and physics at college. Why did I do that? I was never going to be a chemist or a physicist. I just thought I was interested in science. Mm-hmm. Here was an opportunity. I had a lofty idea of what I could get out of college. I thought I could only learn science by taking the labs. So I majored in chemistry and physics and audited literally dozens of other courses in other fields. Harvard was very liberal that way, and it was a terrific experience. But when I got out, when I was a senior, I realized that I had majored in chemistry and physics. I wasn't trained for anything. I was going to have this prestigious degree from what was then the best brand name in American education. I wasn't going to be able to get a job. So I was going to have to go to graduate school. So I had almost all the courses for pre-med. My father was a doctor. I went to the med school. I decided treating people one-on-one was not for me. Then I went to the law school. I spent 3 days there, fell asleep in class. I decided that wasn't a good sign. So I went to the business school the way some people go to television repair school, you know, to learn a trade. And I did.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Byron Ween, vice chairman of Blackstone Investment Advisory and former chief strategist at Morgan Stanley, where he discusses how Harvard changed his life.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Barry Ritholtz, and you're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Today, I am thrilled to have in the studio Byron Wien, former chief strategist at Morgan Stanley and currently working at Blackstone as vice chairman. Is that your...
Vice chairman of one of the divisions.
Of investments. I'm trying to give you a promotion, Byron. Okay. Work with me.
Vice chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners, our investment banking operation.
Got it. So there are a couple of really fascinating things that come out of the discussion of Harvard undergraduate and Harvard graduate. You mentioned you started in 1950, which would really put you at the tail end of the Depression era kids. And one of the things I heard constantly during the financial crisis and the Great Recession afterwards is this is as bad as the Depression. This is the worst thing since the Great Depression. And when I look at the numbers, they don't even seem to be comparable. What was your takeaway of the Great Recession versus the Great Depression?
Well, you've got it right, Barry. The Great Depression was a real depression. The Great Recession was just another experience. In the Great Depression, families lost everything.
Everything.
You know, you would go. I remember my parents showing me a beautiful house in the neighborhood or not in the neighborhood and saying, there live the Smiths or the Joneses. They lost everything in the Depression. Very few people lost everything. The big change between the 1930s and the 1990s or, you know, the current millennium is that the Federal Reserve really played a role. The Federal Reserve provides a safety net for the economy. The Federal Reserve provides liquidity that prevents the Great Depression from returning. And that's the big difference. Household net worth today is higher than it's ever been, but it's accrued mainly to the top 10% of the population. The people at the bottom have suffered. They have actually lost ground over the last 30 years. But the people at the top, and in spite of the declines of 1999, 2000, 2007, 2008, all of them are in better shape. If you have stock holdings and you've watched the market virtually triple since March 9th, 2009, or if you live in an expensive house or apartment, you've watched that appreciate. So you're in better shape. But if you're in the middle 60%, you've done all you could do to hold your own. And if you're in the bottom 20%, you've lost ground.
And 5 years after the 1929 crash, you couldn't say any of those things.
If it weren't for World War II, most of those people wouldn't have come back at all.
And I recall my history, one out of five adult men of working age, unemployed, maybe even one out of four. At some point, we were never even close to a 25% unemployment rate.
Look, the safety net is a lot closer to where you fall
right now,
and it wasn't then.
There was none, and there was no FDIC to prevent all those bank failures from happening.
Absolutely not.
So while we had a number of big bank failures, it was managed. It was nothing like what we saw in 1929.
Now, if you read Thomas Piketty's book, Those periods where the rich were washed out, they were probably healthy for the system because they reduced the inequality problem. The fact that the wealthy were bailed out by the Fed, I mean, if you look at the monetary easing that's been done since 2008, who's benefited? People have money in the stock market. People have expensive houses. So the inequality period, people like you and me who might have lost everything because the stock market collapsed, we didn't. The market came right back. If we held our holdings, we're in better shape now. My net worth is higher than it was in 2009.
That's quite a fascinating. So with that as a backdrop, that obviously had to impact your views on investing. What else affected your perspective? Who were your early influences? Who did you read?
Well, first of all, I didn't get into Wall Street until I was out of business school almost a decade. I wanted to write, as I said, so I went to work for an advertising agency. I hated that. Then I went to work for a management consulting firm, and I liked that. Mm-hmm. And I did some good work there, and a company saw my work or learned about it, and they hired me. I was working in Chicago then, and the company had vending and food, had food service at the World's Fair. So in 1963, I was transferred from Chicago to New York. I didn't know anybody in New York. I had always wanted to live in New York. A.J. Liebling wrote some stories about Chicago and the New Yorker in the 1940s, and they were called The Second City. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't want to live in the Second City. I want to live in the First City. So anyway, when the company offered me a chance to move to New York, I moved to New York. I didn't know anybody in New York, so I made contact with people I'd gone to college and business school with. And one of them had started a small money management firm, and it was very successful, and he needed a security analyst. And he remembered me as a smart kid in business school, so he hired me as a security analyst. I was terrific at spreadsheets in the days when they had spreadsheets, but I couldn't pick stocks. So after a year and a half, it'd probably be hard for you to believe, but I almost got fired from that job.
That's amazing.
He came into my office and said, maybe I ought to look for another job. It isn't working out. But fortunately, the firm was so successful, they needed my body. And so they kept me on. And after about 3 to 6 months, I started to catch on. And, you know, you ask about what I learned. I was desperate to succeed in this job. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe technical analysis will help. So in those days, there was a little group that met every week down on Wall Street and discussed the technical characteristics of the market. I began to go to those weekly meetings, and that really helped a lot. And today, I still use technical analysis, even in my lofty strategy work.
I was going to say, I don't really think of you as a technician. I think of you really as a big picture, and we'll get into some of your travels, big picture macro guy who looks at the whole world.
Well, it's a dirty secret. I don't usually reveal it, but I'm telling you about it.
All right. Well, we'll keep it just between us and the listeners.
Okay. But anyway, it was very helpful in turning my career around, and it's still helpful today.
We're speaking with Byron Wien, Vice Chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners. Coming up, we continue our conversation discussing the smartest man in Europe and how Byron managed to use him as a mentor. Be sure and check out our podcast extras, where you can find extended interviews of all our guests, as well as archives of all our previous interviews. You can find that at Bloomberg.com.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Barry Ritholtz, and you're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Today, I'm sitting with Byron Wien, who is currently Vice Chairman of Investments at Blackstone Advisory Partners. He's CEO and Chairman of Morgan Stanley. No, you pretty much invented the chief strategist role, is how several people described you to me. I'm curious if you think that's an accurate assessment.
It is not.
It is not.
No. Barton Biggs was really the chief strategist. I mean, he invented that role.
Mm-hmm.
And he invented the whole concept of impressionistic strategy, you know, where you wrote in the first person, I think this, I'm doing that, and so forth.
That did not exist beforehand.
No, everybody always said we, and they spoke in behalf of the firm.
Right.
But at Morgan Stanley, I pushed the idea that we should have separate points of view. Sometimes Barton and I wouldn't agree. Now, Barton came to me. I was a portfolio manager. By that time, I had achieved some success and reputation. And he came to me one day. We had breakfast, and we had regular breakfast and always talked about stocks. And he said, I want to change the subject. He said, I'm going to become the head of Morgan Stanley Investment Management, and I'm going to become the global strategist. We need somebody to do the United States. And the sales force, the management, and the research department has met, and they decided you'd be perfect for the job. Morgan Stanley was the most prestigious firm on Wall Street at that time, and it was still a partnership, and they were offering me a partnership. And I thought to myself, wow, boy, this is going to be a life changer you know, and then I found out I was the seventh guy they had approached with, you'd be perfect for the job.
That's but hilarious. Anyway, and they got six no's before you.
Six no's before me. I said yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Harvard changed my life and this changed my life.
So you were at Morgan Stanley when it was, there was Byron Wien, Barton Biggs, and then a guy named Stephen Roach around
Absolutely.
The same time. So how does a firm operate with three guys like that with very, very different philosophies and often conflicting opinions?
Just as the New York Times has people on the op-ed page with different points of view, I argued that we should have that. No other firm had it. Bob Greenhill, who was then president or became president, wanted a single point of view. I thought that was a bad idea and I would quit if that was enforced upon me.
Single point of view, you're either right or wrong. Multiple points of view, hey, someone's going to be right.
Well, maybe. But we didn't always disagree, but we disagreed plenty. But it was the strength of the firm, and it was revitalizing the sales force because they would come to the Monday meeting, and they would listen to us. And look, nobody, no matter how smart you are, nobody takes everything you say and just goes ahead and does it. Mm-hmm. They take it, integrate it, their own thinking, and then act. So we thought we would stimulate a lot more client interest by having different points of view, and it worked. And it was a very strong product, and I'm only sorry it doesn't exist today, not only at Morgan Stanley, but anywhere.
So now let's talk about something else that I really enjoy reading of yours, The Smartest Man in Europe. I've been reading that for how long now?
Well, the first essay I wrote, and I say, was in 2001. And so I've been doing it every year since then. This is a real person. It's a Swiss banker, a guy in his mid-80s. I met him. I became friends with George Soros early in my Wall Street career in the 1960s. We played tennis together, exchanged stock ideas. I ultimately went on his board when he had a public fund.
You helped him write one of his books, didn't
and
you?
I wrote a book with him. Mm-hmm. And we're still friends. We were together last week. Anyway, he introduced me to this guy, and I've been friends of his ever since. And every year I go to Geneva and meet with him, or he comes to New York, and I usually write an essay about it. And he is a breakthrough thinker. He was the first person to ever see the Soviet Union breaking up, the rise of the emerging markets, the peaking out of Japan, the importance of technology, a whole series of things that he was early on. And so he has definitely been one of the people who shaped my life, as has George Soros, as has Barton Biggs, and a lot of other people along the way.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Byron Wien, Vice Chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners and former Chief Strategist for Morgan Stanley, where he discusses how he created the 10 surprising predictions for the coming year.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Today in the studio, I have Byron Wien, formerly of Morgan Stanley, now with Blackstone. And I've been promising we were going to get to his surprise predictions. Unlike most of the street, which makes forecasts as to what might or might not happen, Byron's approach is a little different and, in my opinion, much cleverer than the rest of Wall Street. Instead of predicting what he thinks going to happen, think might happen, he predicts some outliers. Here are some surprises that might happen. I don't think they're going to happen, he writes.
No.
But they're possible. Give us a little detail on what it should be and how it's evolved.
Okay, it's a pretty good story. First of all, let me talk about the surprises. They are surprises, and I'm on the hook for them. They are things I think are probable.
Not possible, probable.
Probable.
Likely to happen.
Better than a 50% probability. In some cases, much better.
So why are they called surprises?
Because if they're, you know, there's something that the average person would give no better than a 1 out of 3 chance of happening. That makes it a surprise.
Ah.
But where I think it's probable.
So they're your probable predictions.
But the
that
average
would be a
person,
surprise to the average person.
That's
quite fascinating.
Okay. So here I am in my first year. It's 1985.
Mm-hmm.
It's my first year as a strategist. I'm competing with Lee Hooperman and Stan Salvickson and Greg Smith and a whole slew of very smart guys. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got to do something nobody else is doing. I've got to do something to separate because I'm not smarter than they are. I don't believe I'm smarter than they are. Or if I am, I'll never be able to prove it. But I could be different. I could do something they're not doing.
A little outside of the box thinking.
Right. So I went to Morgan Stanley. I said, I have this idea of coming up with 10 surprises. And I defined it with the 1/3 50 probable argument. They turned it down. I said, why are you turning it down? They said, well, you can get all 10 wrong. And that would embarrass the firm and you would be humiliated. Your humiliation, we don't give a damn about. But our embarrassment, we do. And I said, look, this is a good idea. I really believe this is a good idea. You keep thinking about it, and I'm going to keep pushing. At the end of my first year, end of 85, they said, okay, you can try it in January of 86. Right at the beginning, first week of the year, you come out with your 10 surprises. And I did it. And I can't say it was a big hit from the start, but it was something different. The media picked it up. Clients were interested in it. And it was off and running. And this next edition will be the 30th edition of
wow.
it. And Blackstone is making a big fuss about it. In any case, I've had very good years and I've had bad years, as you would expect. I had a string of years, 95, 93, 4, and 5, where I got 7 out of the 10 right. And usually I get 5 or 6 right. But I don't do it for score. I do it to stretch people's thinking. But those 3 years, I got 7 right. 3 years in a row, and I was on the cover of Barron's. And the article said, there are a lot of people on Wall Street who say they can predict the future. This guy really can. That was the worst year I ever had.
So the magazine cover curse,
yeah,
you ended
exactly.
up, you got shut out the following year, or what'd you end
no,
up with?
No, it was 1996 itself. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I kept doing it. And I've had, in 2009, I got 9 out of 10 right.
Wow. Any years where you really embarrassed yourself?
Oh, sure. I've had years where I only got 2 right.
Mm-hmm.
And people understand that. And one of the, I remember when I took this job in 1985, I went to Lee Hooperman, who was a friend of mine. And I said, Lee, Morgan Stanley offered me the job of being the U.S. strategist. What do you think? Lee said, it's a terrible job. I mean, he was doing it for Goldman. He said, it's a terrible job. He said, and you're a successful portfolio manager. Why would you want to give that up and do this? I said, Lee, I think if I do that job and I'm successful at it, it'll make me happier than I've ever been. I said, I'm a good portfolio manager, but I'm not world class. I think I might be world class at this. And I'd like to be world class at something before it's all over. And he said, it's a very slippery pole. So I decided to take the job. And he said, why are you doing it? I said, Lee, I went to the bottom of the pole. There were no bodies there. You know, somehow, even when you're wrong, you survive as a strategist.
That's really fascinating. And for people who may not know who Leon Cooperman is, runs an extremely successful hedge fund. And the irony is, he was a strategist for many years. I believe he was 55 when he launched the hedge fund.
Yeah, he's 71 now, and he's been doing it since 92.
So about 20 years ago, that's about right.
Yeah.
That's quite an amazing run to start a whole new career.
And he's been very successful.
Tremendously, tremendously successful. And another mutual friend of Leon and yourself is a mentor of mine, Doug Cass. And Doug does a variation of your surprising surprises each year with all due credit to you. He publishes it each I believe it's each January.
Right. He does it. He publishes 15. it's interesting that you bring him up because he always gives me credit, and he and I are friends, and I wrote a blurb for his book that's about to come out, and saying I've learned a lot from him. When, as I told you, Morgan Stanley turned it down right at the beginning. But when it was successful, everybody came into my office at one time or another who was on the tribunal committee that turned it down, patted me on the back and said, I'm really glad I supported you in that 10 surprise idea.
Hey, don't tell the other guys, but I was fighting for it.
Yeah, right.
And you, we did the best we could.
Yeah.
You know, that's the old joke. Invention has
many fathers.
Right. That's really amazing. People want to grab.
Well, anyway, after it was successful, Morgan Stanley took a service mark out on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Merrill copied it, and Morgan Stanley threatened them with a lawsuit. And because they put out 10 surprises without any recognition whatsoever. And others have done it too, as you alluded to in your introduction.
It's now trademarked to Morgan Stanley? Is that true?
Well, not service marked to Morgan Stanley. When I left, I said I assumed I was going to leave it at Morgan Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody at Morgan Stanley wanted to take the risk of doing it.
Well, so big shoes, big footprints to follow.
Right. So I said, okay, if nobody's going to do it, I want it. So please license it to me. So they have licensed it to me for life. And every year I have to go over there and do a presentation of the 10 surprises on the second day, the day after they're out, because I can do it at Blackstone the day they're out. And I have to give them a dollar.
That's great. I love that story. So that sort of collegiality isn't necessarily still how the street operates. This is a good opportunity to look at how have things changed over the course of your career. Obviously, the technology has changed and high-frequency trading and all that. But from your perspective, from management, from strategists, from portfolio management, what do you see that's different today, and what does this mean to investors?
Well, I think it's like the difference between a bicycle and an automobile.
Right.
You know, they're both means of transportation, but they're very different. And when I went to work in Wall Street in 1985, only DLJ was public, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were still private partnerships and so forth. So now every firm is public. And the big banks weren't really in the investment banking, and now they are. The compensation, you know, when I got out of school, out of business school in 1956, what somebody who went to work in Wall Street or a doctor or a lawyer made out of school was about the same. And 5 years later, it was about the same. But in 1980, all that changed. And the compensation of people in Wall Street began to soar, and the compensation of doctors and lawyers didn't. They did better, but they didn't do as well. Wall Street began. Unless, you know, the only way to be a millionaire before you were 40 is if you could hit a baseball or swing a tennis racket or play a guitar. But now you could be a nerdy person and make $1 million by managing somebody else's money. And hedge funds hadn't really gotten going until the 1980s either. And so that changed everything. So the big clients of Morgan Stanley in 85 were all the mutual funds and the big pension funds. Today, the big clients are all the hedge funds. So the whole character of the business changed, and the whole character of investment banking changed. Morgan Stanley used to have a principle that they would only be the lead underwriter. They wouldn't be lower down on the scale, and that all changed. The business became much more competitive. It used to be an investment business. Today, it's a corporate business, and the character of the major firms is a corporate character, not a partnership character. And that's very different from what it was in 1985.
Thank you, Byron, for spending so much time with us. I've been speaking with Byron Wien, Vice Chairman of Blackstone Advisory Partners and former Chief Strategist for Morgan Stanley. If you enjoy these interviews, be sure and check out our full archive of past conversations. That's on Masters in Business. You can find it at Bloomberg.com. My daily column shows up at BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome back to the podcast extras. I'm Barry Ritholtz, and I'm here speaking with Byron Wien, who actually today is the first day you and I met. We've actually first started emailing because you tagged me about something I had written about income inequality, some of the numbers that had come out of once the Piketty book came out, and then some of the data that had come out from a combination of the IRS and a few other sources were just astonishing how massive just a handful of people's wealth had become. And we're not talking about the Steve Jobs or Bill Gates of the world who built a company. We're talking about some of the hedge fund guys and some of the people who are basically not building something but shuffling paper around that you alluded to earlier. So that's how you and I first met. But I knew you through the smartest man in Europe, through the surprising predictions, through a number of things that you had written over the years. And I'm going to throw some quotes at you and have you discuss them because I find they're really quite fascinating. So when Barton Biggs was at Morgan Stanley and he became global strategist and you were their first choice to be U.S. strategist,
seventh choice,
same. You know, as far as they wanted you to know, you're the perfect guy.
Right,
you're
the
first choice. You were doing all domestic coverage, but you lately, and by lately, the past decade or so, have been traveling a great deal. And here's a quote I read of yours recently. Over the past 2 years, I've been to China 5 times, the Middle East twice, Latin America, Europe countless times, as well as all over the United States. You're now in your 80s. Why travel so much? Why not just kick back and relax, enjoy the money you've accumulated over the years? You have the work schedule of a 30-year-old.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's an intense work schedule. I know that.
A 40-year-old? Is that fair
Maybe.
To say?
But look at Barry, I'm going to different places all the time. It isn't like every 2 weeks I have to go to Cleveland. You know, I'm traveling
no
around the world.
No offense to Cleveland, but
I've met people over the years. Mm-hmm. I have friends in a lot of these places. I try on the longer trips to do something that I enjoy, build a vacation on back of it. Last year I had to go to Hong Kong second time, and I went to Myanmar afterwards. And whenever I go to Europe on a 2-week period, I try to spend the weekend in Paris. I bring my wife when I can, when I think it's worthwhile. But a lot of those trips are one night stands. Mm-hmm. I went to over 2 weeks. I was in 8 different cities in Asia. I don't know how many on a 2-week trip. I was probably in a similar number of cities in Europe. It is intense, I learned something on the trips, and I feel as long as I've said, if you work forever, you can live forever. So far, that's working. I know there's a lot of biological evidence against that theory, but I'm going with it anyway. So the point is that if you keep yourself at risk, if you feel you're always learning, life is pretty much a thrill. I look forward to waking up in the morning and going to work. Now I've rationalized the travel. I try not to go on a long trip, a 1 week or a 2 week trip, more than once a month. Mm-hmm. I try to have breaks in between because in addition to the travel, I've got to write the monthly essays. I prepare a quarterly webinar. I change my presentation every quarter. I have to see clients in the office as well as when I travel. I have to advise every division of the firm internally on their strategy. So there's a lot to do every day.
Wow, that is quite the extensive schedule. That's really amazing. You're not going to be a guy retiring to Florida, hitting a golf hitting a golf ball or standing on the side of a dock holding a fishing rod. That no way that's in your future.
No, I'm you know, I don't work all the time. You know, I have lots of interests. You know, I have sports interests. I sail, play tennis, ski, swim. I have lots of intellectual interests. I'm very interested in the theater. I read a lot.
Which, by the way, is a theme that has come up in every single one of these interviews. Every person I've spoken to, from David Rosenberg, who's the phone was ringing, he said to say hi to you, to Mike Mabuson, Arthur Levitt, Gunlock, go down the list. Jim O'Shaughnessy, they all say the same thing. They spend an extraordinary amount of time reading.
Yeah, and look, I'm learning all the time. You know, the wonderful thing about, you know, people ask me what I learned at Harvard that was so valuable. It's the importance of critical thinking. When I was on the Crimson, I was a movie reviewer. That's critical thinking at a lower level. But it taught me to go to a movie and sit there and know that as soon as I get out of the movie, I got to go over to the Crimson Building and write a review of that movie. Mm-hmm. And so it got my mind making decisions on whether something was good or bad or right or wrong, you know, even in my teenage years.
Hmm. So I have another quote of yours that I want to read to you and see where we go with. I thought this was kind of interesting. And this, I dug this up before the Scotland vote, which we're having this conversation the day before. But this has to do with the political situation in both U.S. and Europe. And you had written, it seems clear that the United States and Europe are mature, over-leveraged economies with dysfunctional governments. Address that a little bit, because that's quite a significant statement. Over-leveraged and dysfunctional.
Okay, well, I'm not backing away from it. If you're challenging me, let's just think about the U.S. If you just look at our balance sheet now, mm-hmm. We've improved the budget deficit from 10% to 3%, but it's still 3%. Mm-hmm. We're still adding to our debt. Let me ruin the weekend for you. When the Republic was founded in 1792, we had no debt. And from 1792 until the year 2000, we built up $6 trillion in debt.
$6 trillion over
200 years.
Right.
$6 trillion, you know. Revolutionary War, War of 1812, Civil War, Spanish-American, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, $6 trillion in debt. Now, 14 years later, the debt is $17 trillion.
Almost triple.
Almost triple in 14 years. Now, let me give you another number. The blended interest rate on that $6 trillion was 6%, or $360 billion. The blended interest rate on the 17 is a similar number. Why? Because the blended interest rate has gone from 6% to 2.13. Now, if interest rates ever normalize, I'm not saying if or when they will.
But we all know they eventually have to.
That's going to be a tremendous hit. In addition to that, we have our population is aging, and they are going to need more government support of their healthcare programs and their retirement programs. So it's possible that the debt burden in the United States could increase exponentially. So that's the over-leveraged part. Okay, now let's do the dysfunctional part. The dysfunctional part is, name an important piece of legislation other than the Affordable Care Act that's been passed. We can't pass immigration. We can't pass gun control. We can't pass a revision of the tax code. We can't get anything done in Congress. And then let's go to Europe. Europe has similar financial problems, And in addition to that, while they have a European Union, which has a common currency, they don't have a banking union. They don't have any fiscal convergence. So the clock is ticking on the European Commission to bring Europe closer together. It'll never have a true political union, but it could be much closer in terms of its monetary union. And it hasn't done that. So everybody kind of sits on their hands and muddles through. And the long-term implications of that are scary for both continents.
So one of the books that sits on my desk that I am slowly fighting my way through is Triumph of the Optimists. And it explains how over the long haul, there's always these problems, but we always seem to overcome them. And I'm taking a century of quantitative data and reducing it, and a 400-page tome and reducing it to one sentence. So looking out a couple of decades, are we still going to see the optimist's triumph? Is that what is the fate, or have we dug ourselves into a hole and it's going to be a rough slog for a while?
Well, the two aren't mutually exclusive. It could be a rough slog for a while, but the optimist can triumph. And I think if you look at the history, look, in 2008, our banking system was in danger of melting down.
Completely.
I mean, banks would have closed if the Fed hadn't stepped in there. The balance sheet of the Federal Reserve in 2008 was $1 trillion. It was formed in 1913. From 1913 to 2008, 95 years, it built up a $1 trillion balance sheet. Almost overnight, it went to $2.5 trillion. If it hadn't done that, the banks would have melted down. Everybody criticizes the system because the fat cats benefited and the average person didn't. But the average person would have been nowhere if the banks had failed.
Would have been much, much worse.
Right.
And potentially a Great Depression.
Yeah. What Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner did over that weekend when Lehman failed was miraculous. I'm not saying it was perfect, but I don't know three guys who could have done a better job.
That's quite amazing. That's quite a statement.
Yeah. So, that was very important. So in a crisis, we seem to rise to the occasion, but that's what it takes for us to draw the best out of what we have. So I'm only telling you that we're going to have some crises going forward. But I'm also telling you, I'm on the side of the guy who wrote that book. Somehow we'll step in and do the right thing.
I'm trying to remember, it might have been Winston Churchill. There was a famous quote about America, which was,
it was bigger than America. Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others.
And that's in general. I was specifically thinking about you could rely on the United States to do the right thing after they've exhausted all other possibilities.
Right, after they've tried everything else.
Right, that might have been Churchill.
No, that was definitely Churchill.
Okay, it's... It sounds like him. So you're not preaching doom and gloom. You're saying, hey, we got some heavy lifting ahead, but history tells us that we'll find our way through it, assuming we exhaust all other possibilities and do the right thing. Here's another quote that I think is kind of interesting, and I want to discuss both sides of this. I have made more money than I ever thought possible, and now I spend part of my time trying to give it away effectively. So without getting into specific numbers, because it's nobody else's business, you can whisper in my ear later.
You
were a partner at Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Stanley went public, and you were a fairly senior guy. So that had to be a reasonable windfall. And now you're with Blackstone, and they're a enormously successful company that had to generate some money, plus your own investing over years.
I've made more money investing than
anything else. Let's before we go on, your personal portfolio, your own investments, that's where all your money was made. Where the bulk of your wealth came from.
No, I've always tried to invest in open-ended situations. So I've had consistent investments in technology and biotechnology.
Mm-hmm. And they've done very well.
And the tax laws, you don't pay taxes on appreciation.
Right.
You only pay taxes when you sell. I'll give you a good example. I recently gave a professorship to Harvard in stem cell research and microbiology. It was $4 million. I gave Gilead stock that I had bought 25 years ago.
25 years ago. It's got to be like a buck or two.
Yeah. My cash cost for that for that $4 million was $25,000.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. You know,
and there's no taxes because you're giving it as a gift.
Right, exactly. I'm giving it as a gift. And, you know, and I've got a, that's not the only stock like that I've got. And so the point is that buying and holding, if you buy the right thing,
right,
can really pay off for you. And also, I've always wanted to have a good time working.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to make the most money. I liked money management, but I always thought there was something I could do better, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I could be a better strategist than a money manager. I can assure you, if I were a money manager, you wouldn't have me on the program. You know, I'd be just another guy. Maybe I'd be an A-minus money manager, but I wouldn't be a Stan Druckenmiller or a Lee Cooperman or
right,
one of those people.
But yet you're a legendary strategist.
Right. There's a perfect job out there for everyone, Barry. Maybe you found it. I finally found it. But I was almost 50 years old before I found it.
That's quite amazing. And had almost been fired
right
early in your career.
Absolutely.
So other than the professorial chair at Harvard, what other sort of charities?
Well, that was the second chair I gave. I gave a chair in drama. I was always interested in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave so that's the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of Drama. So I've given two chairs at Harvard. And I've given numerous scholarships. I gave a scholarship for orphans, the mm-hmm. so-called orphans scholarship, because I was one. There aren't too many orphans, thank God, these days, but there are kids who have lost one parent of the same sex, and they qualify if you lose mm-hmm. a parent of the same sex. I've given a lot of scholarships for foreign students to go to Harvard. So I've tried to pay back Harvard for changing my life. And then I've been on various boards, the New York Historical Society, Phoenix House, Ackerman Institute for Family Therapy, on and on. And I have a philosophy in philanthropy, and it's I try to relieve pain rather than spread joy.
Mm-hmm.
So I give a limited amount of money to art museums, music, and theater. But I give a lot of money to education, social service, and healthcare. And those are my focuses.
And one of the things that really stood out in a quote about your philanthropy was effectively. And we read about some charities that run into problems. And how does we work with a number of clients? How do you advise wealthy investors or even families that may not be wealthy but want to make a difference? How do you advise them to use their money effectively in philanthropic pursuits?
Well, I wouldn't give any money to anybody who doesn't measure the effectiveness of what they do. Places like Robin Hood and the Harlem Children's Zone really do a very good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of places don't. And, you know, look at the numbers. If how many people do they serve? What are the results of the people they serve? You know, you've got to hold your not-for-profit accountable. A lot of not-for-profits are run very badly, and you've got to make sure that if you're giving serious money to a not-for-profit, they're doing a good job of using that money.
There are a couple of websites like Charity Navigator and others that show you the administrative overhead. It's shocking, some of the statistics, 30, 40, 50% just goes to more fundraising.
Right.
So the money you're donating never makes it to its It never makes it to its intended beneficiary. And the other day I saw something interesting about the Red Cross has been very reluctant to release its information on how the Sandy money was spent.
Oh, really?
So that's been a little bit of a interesting controversy. And they're generally thought of as a very reliable, very good charity. I don't want to paint them with too negative of a brush, but that's fascinating. And in fact, the reason Warren Buffett gave when he shifted his assets to Bill Gates' charity is, hey, Bill's a smart guy and he's figured out how to spend the money effectively.
And how to measure the effectiveness of it.
Not just spreading it around, but making sure it has.
Yeah, as Warren said, you know, I'm good at making it. And Bill is not only good at making it, but he's good at giving it away.
Giving it away. So there's a couple of other things I wanted to get to while I still have you in the room. I know I only have you for a few more minutes. We were talking earlier about identifying secular change. That's one of the things you do when you're looking at a macro perspective. What sort of secular changes are you seeing? How does the travel influence that? Tell us a little bit about secular change and the difference between shorter term or let's call it cyclical change.
Well, I'll talk about a couple of them. First of all, the middle class in the developing world is expanding exponentially. And that's probably the most positive thing I can say about what's going on right now. The middle class in China and India and Latin America and even in some places in Africa is expanding. And that the consumer, the standard of living is rising in all those places. So that's one very important secular change. A second secular change is on the other side of it. One of the things that fascinates me, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this, Barry, I can't conceive of the next 30 years being as dramatic in terms of technology change as the last 30 years. The last 30 years with the internet, the cell phone, fax machine, everything else, doesn't seem to me the next 30 could be that dramatic. Yet when I talk to people in Silicon Valley, they assure me it'll be as dramatic, maybe even faster than the last 30 years. So that's the good news. The bad news is every time a new app comes out, somebody loses a job. Sometimes thousands of people lose their job. Think of all the things people used to do for you, pumping gas, bank tellers, you name it. There are a lot of things that aren't done by people anymore, but are done electronically. And as a result, we have a secular employment problem in this country, and it's structural. It isn't going to change. The institutional salesman who was covering you and has lost his job and was making a six-figure income, he's be lucky to get a five-figure income going forward. So this is a problem. The inequality problem is going to get worse, and it's going to become a political issue, maybe not in November, but in 2016 for sure. So there's a structural problem in employment in the developed countries. Teenage unemployment in Europe is very serious. And there's a structural change positively in the developed world in terms of the expanding middle class. And there's money to be made in understanding both of those changes.
So let's talk about technology in the few minutes we have left. So the basic theory is that each technological innovation actually speeds up the pace of change. The so-called second derivative is accelerating because more things are changing and they're changing more quickly. And these huge game changers actually shift, like the internet, shift the entire dynamic. Think about what the internet enabled that wasn't even imaginable in the 90s. You had YouTube and Google and Facebook. You didn't have the connectivity. You didn't have the bandwidth for those sort of outlets. And that's just on that side. You mentioned biotech. I've been fascinated reading about the various cancer therapies and the different approaches. One approach is to treat each cancer as having a unique genetic type and being able to identify that and come up with a therapy that's specific to that cancer for that person. There's another theory that says there are ways that cancer hides itself from the body that's in the protein coding around each cell, and people are now working on different ways to allow your own white blood cells to identify cancer and attack it as if it was any other invading function. And then there are other therapies that are looking at, well, this is something that's taking place at the end of the end of the DNA helix. And if we just repair those things, we can arrest it at its point. It's no longer as invasive. And that's just off the top of my head. I find that sort of stuff fascinating. And I can't imagine that 25 years from now, there's not going to be some sort of a, you know, if we're having this conversation a few decades in the future, it's probably going to be closer to, well, they just cured this cancer and they cured that cancer and they came up with this therapy that attacked this whole line of cancer. If it's not going to be cured, I really think it's going to be managed in the future very differently than today.
I think you're right. I think cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, hepatitis C,
diabetes.
You know, all diabetes for sure. All of these things are going to be improved. But the result is people are going to live longer and it's going to be more of a burden.
It's going to be an expense, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, but it's absolutely true. I think even, you know, for someone my age, I think my quality of life is much higher than it would have been if I had, than it would have been 50 years ago.
No doubt about it. And that's before we even begin talking about advances in energy, in nanotechnology. I don't have a 3D printer, but I find the concept fascinating. And yeah. I got to imagine at some point in the future, they're going to say, hey, this guy needs a pancreas. Let's just print one for him.
I don't know if we'll get that far.
You put a drop of blood into a machine, and what comes out the other end is going to be an organ. That's not unthinkable 100 years hence.
I do know that the advances in biotechnology are going to be truly dramatic. I mean, there's a lot going on in the private and academic sectors in this area.
All right, so my last question, I saved my favorite quote of yours for last, and I want you, this is the perfect segue to that. I love this quote. I still ski, play tennis, sail, and make love, although my skills at all of these have deteriorated.
Yeah, you have to adjust. You know, I mean, I was a really good competitive tennis player. I even was a pretty good skier. I won't comment on making love, but you know, you get older. Look, my parents died when they were in their 40s. You know, I'm almost twice as old as they were, and I have a very good life. I can have enough money to do whatever I want. I don't live extravagantly. It's true. I can't do some of the athletic things I did before, but I can still do them, and I just adjust to the level I can do them at. The goal of life is to be a happy person. When I first started out, I thought I was going to achieve status by having a lot of money. Because going to work at 15, you were very conscious of not having enough money. But I realized that, you know, that isn't going to do it for me. I'm not going to be happy no matter how much money I have. And then I got this job as a strategist, and all of a sudden I found out that through my writing, I was achieving status. It had nothing to do with money. So all you want is your 15 minutes of fame, you know, and I got that not through money, but through what I do intellectually. And that I derive a lot of happiness from it. And as long as I have enough money to live a reasonable life, that's it. Most people don't realize the goal of life is to be happy. Money is a part of it for sure, but it's a long way from the only part of it.
Byron, thank you so much for spending so much time with me and our audience today. This has really been a fascinating conversation. I've been speaking with Byron Wien, who's vice chairman at Blackstone, former chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley. You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.